And our next item, 10.
Yes, item 10 is an overview of the Active Oilfield Regulatory Program, which is a new program for us and statewide. John Robertson, Matthew Keeling, and Aaron Katona of our newly formed unit, Active Oilfield Regulatory Program Unit, will be presenting an overview of our oil and gas extraction-related oversight in coordination with the State Water Board and Department of Conservation, Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, also known as DAR. More specifically, they'll give a primer on oil and gas extraction-related activities, talk about recent legislation and what it requires with respect to regulating hydraulic fracturing and the underground injection or surface disposal of wastewater produced during oil and gas extraction. To kick things off, John's going to introduce our new staff that I mentioned to you a little bit earlier.
Good morning. Good morning, board members. Thank you, Lisa. Chairman Wolf. There's a touch of symbolism in our talk today, in that I'll lead off, as I was the only person in the Active Oil Field Program 2 years ago, and then I'll hand it off to semi-new recruits, and then we'll also introduce you to the newest recruits. And I'm really pleased and excited with the group we've assembled. There's a luxury of being in San Luis Obispo, you get a cherry pick talent. And it's not hard to talk when you come into San Luis. Okay, so we're going to talk about the big picture here, and on some level, we've had some conversations, I've answered some questions you've had about active oil field regulation, but now we're going to do the big reveal, and you're going to see into the program and see into some of the legislation that's driving the program. So this is an overview of our presentation today. Okay, so 2 years ago, Ken Harris and I got an all expenses paid trip to Bakersfield. Sounds good, huh? And that was at the inception of the SB4 regulation development process. SB4 is a hydraulic fracturing regulation for the state. Subsequent to SB4, SB83, which is kind of a garbage bin full of information in terms of the Senate bill, includes underground injection control and produced water pond regulations, in addition to a myriad of other things. It's a trailer bill associated with the budget, so it had a lot of information packed into it. Through that legislation, SB4 provided us one position, which is Aaron Katona. And then subsequent to that, 2 years later, in this current budget, we were provided two additional positions, that is Mike McKee and Nick Smyra. And a gentleman called Matt Keeling, too. Yeah, we get it. Super talented guy. Okay, so now I'm going to introduce you to the new staff. Let's go with Nick first. So Nick is an aspiring, a future professional geologist, I'll say, who comes to us from the Central Valley region. We cherry picked him out of the Fresno office. Nick has a great background. He's worked on active oil field regulation, and I've already told Angela, hands off. I've already told Angela from her office, hands off. He's working on oil fields for now. And then he also worked at the dairy program, which is it. Both of those programs are hugely political, hot items in the Central Valley. Nick comes with GIS background, which we think is going to be also very important, and is a criteria that we establish for almost all the hiring we're doing nowadays. Communicating information in a geospatial way is very important for the decision making. He also has a background with geochemistry, and he will be he has a background with WDR development. We anticipate that that's a likely direction this program will have to head as we deal with the ponds, the unregulated ponds that exist in our region used to dispose of the production water in the oil fields. So, welcome, Nick. Glad to have you. Okay, Mike McKee. This is kind of a funny story. I met Mike late in the Reagan administration, in the late 80s, right? As two young geologists. Mike is a, we'll say, seasoned professional geologist, certified hydrogeologist as well. He has, I'm going to say, pushing 30 years experience in hydrogeology related to groundwater characterization and also landfills and Title 27 specialized regulation associated with landfills and ponds. And that will be hugely beneficial for us going forward as we try to permit oil field facilities. Mike comes to us most recently from the Dogger office in Fresno. I'm sorry, the Dogger office in Bakersfield, which is where Aaron came to us from. And that'll help us with our sort of window into Dogger, who is a partner in the regulation of active oil fields. It'll help us understand the culture a little bit better, and it'll help us to make contacts within those offices too, because he has established working contacts there. Okay, I think that's it. I want to say welcome to both of them. Welcome, Mike. Glad you guys joined us.
And, you know, very glad to see that you have assembled an excellent, talented team to keep Mr. Ken Harris out of trouble. Inside joke. Mr. Harris, for those of you in the public may not be familiar with his name, was the executive officer of our Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. He's been asked by the governor to head the Dogger Department, so this is our role. Our little attempt to a mild sense of humor.
Yeah, inside joke.
Can you explain what the Dogger?
Yeah, I was just going to do that, Bruce. Sorry to be honest, Dogger. In the spirit of de-acronymizing ourselves, Dogger is the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources. And Bruce, you can see why we now call it Dogger instead of all of that. And they are charged with oversight of oil fields. That's their role in the state government. Okay. Back to the presentation. So we're in the inception of this program, and we're still developing goals and objectives. And literally last week, I think it was, we had our first group strategic planning session, where we're trying to develop what kind of performance measures do we need to demonstrate that we're being effective in protecting water resources, both surface and groundwater resources, adjacent to and beneath active oil fields. It's so early in the process that I can't articulate to you essentially what they will be, but they'll likely be traditional measures like groundwater quality adjacent to the fields. That's in line with what we've discussed for the Arroyo Grande aquifer exemption, with century wells surrounding the exempted aquifer. Find water quality outside of the exemption zone and demonstrate to residents in the vicinity that the groundwater is still being protected. And I want to emphasize that this is a shared regulatory authority here. It's a little unique. You know, traditionally we will regulate an MPDES facility. With oil fields, it's a hodgepodge of authority. And we, along with US EPA, Dogger, and State Board, regulate these facilities. And it also creates a non-traditional role for us in that often we're kind of in the backseat of the regulatory car. We don't have a stated place in regulation, for example, aquifer exemptions or underground injection control. But State Board incorporates us as kind of a technical consultant on ground and surface water. So we offer them a kind of objective opinion that is outside the clearly defined regulatory process. And if I could do one more introduction, I'm going to introduce John Borkovich, who is the state board program lead for active oil field regulation. In addition to, he also runs GAMA, or the groundwater assessment.
Ambient monitoring and assessment.
Thank you. Which has a huge web presence in addition to being a monitoring program. Okay, so just to kind of further go into what our role is, we serve as a technical advisory capacity to state board and DOGGR for the injection of fluids. This falls under federal regulations, and specifically these are for aquifer exemptions and for underground injection control. Then we serve we fill our more traditional role with respect to permitting waste discharges.
Sorry.
Associated with oil and gas production. So oil fields produce a lot of water, as Aaron will let you know here in a bit. Much more water than oil. And they have to deal with it. And so that waste is something that falls under our more traditional regulatory purview, waste discharge requirements. And then, of course, one thing that we do is enforcement is necessary. In Region 5 produces the lion's share of oil in the state, approximately, I'm going to say 80%, ballpark 80% of the oil in the state. And they're a little bit ahead of us in terms of evaluating risk from injection and from produce water ponds. And their experience is enforcement is a very necessary tool in this process. And I don't want to presuppose that we have to go down that road, but I'm also taking that information into account is the scenario that's playing out in Region 5 has required a significant amount of enforcement time. That may be our reality too. I'm informed that way, but I'm also hopeful. So, and the end game is that we're protecting the beneficial use, particularly the drinking water beneficial use, because so much of this that we're talking about is injection and exemption of aquifers.
So good morning, my name is Aaron Katona, and John already introduced me, and I'm going to be leading the technical portion of this presentation, and then I'll be handing it off to Matt Hillen. So before we get started, I want to define some things. This is a highly technical field, oil and gas production. And these are some of the definitions that I'll be using throughout the slide presentation. Keep in mind, these definitions are not necessarily universal. Some of these are regional, and some of these definitions are even not necessarily used the same way by the regulatory industry, or the oil industry and the regulators. But I'm trying to give you a good overall general definition. So enhanced oil recovery. This refers specifically to different methods used to recover oil that differ from the traditional drill hole in the ground pump of oil. I'm going to go into more in depth about what those methods are later on, but when you hear that word, that's what I'm referring to. Well stimulation treatment is in a sense, a type of enhanced oil recovery, or can be. Hydraulic fracturing would be one of the more famous ones. There's other things like acid treatments as well. And it refers to methods that increase the flow to a production well, a well that pumps oil. Produced hydraulic fracturing, I will cover more in-depthly. That is when you essentially pressurize water down a well bore and open up fractures, and I'll go into more in-depth about that, particularly that. Produced water is water that comes up with oil. So oftentimes within a oil reservoir, there is a quantity of water that is intermixed with the oil. And operators have to do something with this. Two of the methods that we are specifically dealing with in our region, or at least the forefront of our, the Underground Injection Control Program, which is the only acronym I will be using for the day. So, and there's a reason for that. UIC is what it's often referred to, and the EPA designed this program and has given either primacy to certain states that apply for this program, or it has it regulates the state itself, or the state itself can apply for sole regulation. And I'll go further into detail about what those UIC, that program in particular, and the wells that are associated with that. And then produced water ponds, which is not as common as it used to be, but it's still an issue. Much more common in the Central Valley, and we'll discuss that. And that is essentially where there's an excavation in the ground that's temporary or permanent, and this produced water is either put there temporarily or the produced water is used or placed there to evaporate or to percolate the soil. Well site sumps are excavations in the ground that are used, that are temporary and are associated with the drilling rigs. So when a rig, a drilling rig, which is, I'll go back to the slides, this right here is an example of a drilling rig. When that is drilling, fluids come up with it, or with the cuttings, and fluids are used to circulate or to keep hydrostatic pressure in the well bore. And so something must be done with these, and that's typically what was used in the past with sump, though operators have been moving away from that. And then finally, aquifer exemptions. Aquifer exemptions are areas where the EPA has allowed for injection to, underground injection to happen for what are known as class two wells, which are the injection wells that oil and gas operators use. And in order for, in some cases, in order for an aquifer to be used as an injection zone, it must be first exempted as a process that involves that. And I'll elaborate on that as well. So quickly, I'd like to give you a background about oil production in California. This picture here is the Santa Barbara oil field circa 1902. You can see there's wooden derricks, oil derricks on the shore, and they go back out into the ocean there off those piers. We don't do this too much anymore. In fact, I don't think we see this much anymore. You might have seen some of the oil rigs off the coast there. But this is just to illustrate that there's a long history of oil production in California. In fact, the first recorded well or production well was goes back to 1865, and I believe it was in San Francisco. Prior to that, the Native Americans used natural oil seeps, and the European settlers, when they came, they also used the oil from natural oil seeps for things such as pitch, to line boats, and for fuel to burn. We are the third largest oil producing state. We used to be number two, and North Dakota recently overtook us. Texas is number one. And of the three waterborne regions, regions 3, 4, and 5 have the vast bulk of the share of oil production going on in them. The majority of the onshore oil is production is in Kirkcon. I think John already spoke to that, about 80% or so is in the Central Valley region. We have 204 active oil fields statewide. I believe there's 400 to 500 plus oil fields that are abandoned or inactive. So there, but of those, only 204 are considered active today. And we have 47 active oil fields in the Central Coastal region. Mm-hmm. This is a map so you can develop a sense of how these oil, gas, and geothermal fields are dispersed throughout the state. The oil field boundaries sign like there's actually a typo. I should have said oil, gas, and geothermal. The vast majority of these are oil and gas. There's a couple of geothermal sites located throughout the map, but it still portrays the overall sense of the different areas where oil production happens. And you can see, once again, the Central Valley has the bulk. We have quite a bit here in the Central Coast, and then Los Angeles and Santa Ana have some as well. So this is our region. This is Region 3. I divide this map into two sections. The North Central Coast region is on the left, and that's so we can get more of a microscopic view, so to speak, of what's going on here.
The big producing oil field in the north part of our region is the San Arlo oil field, which is down at the bottom of the south side of the north map. I think that way from where I'm working, right there. There it is, San Arlo. I'll talk more about that particular oil field in a few slides, because there's some interesting things going on there. This is the southern portion of the south, on the right side is the south portion of our region. And the major oil fields, producing oil fields, are the Santa Maria Valley and Cat Canyon. There is some production that goes on offshore as well, but a lot is going on right through here. Now, there are quite a few offshore rigs that can be seen easily from the highway. However, we only have one within our region that falls in state waters, and that's the Holly platform. Everything else is outside of state waters. It's 2 miles, more than 2 miles off the coast, and it is under the authority of the federal government. We do not have a say in those oil platforms. I just want to touch on that real quick. Okay. Real briefly, I'd like to educate or re-educate ourselves on what oil is. We're going to be talking about this fluid, and I think it's a good idea to know exactly what it is. So, common contrary belief, oil is not made from dinosaur bones. The most widely accepted theory is that it is composed from small marine organisms that were deposited, that fell and died to the ocean floor, or a lake as well, floor of some water body. They were buried, they were heated up, they were pressurized, and they slowly turn into the substance called kerogen. Now, kerogen is a proto-oil, in a sense. As time goes by and this kerogen is heated up and pressurized even more, you start to develop hydrocarbons, or petroleum, and natural gas. This is when humans start to step in at this phase and start to become involved in oil production. And this is where we'll start growing. This is a little misleading down here. Oil deposits don't have to be this old. In fact, in California, we have much younger oil deposits, geologically speaking, maybe tens of millions of years. However, the good stuff is usually older. That's what they have back east. The crude is more developed and is usually thinner. It's not thick. We have some really thick stuff here in California, which is one of the reasons why we use a lot of enhanced oil recovery techniques. So, oil and gas production in a way is similar to drilling is similar to a water well at first glance. You have a drill rig, the drill rig drills a hole in the ground, a casing is put into it, it's usually cemented, the drill rig moves off site, and a wellhead is put on. However, things quickly become complicated, and can become complicated, as you can see from here. I'll take this moment to say too that because production can be highly sophisticated and it's consistently evolving, it's changing, and it's becoming more and more advanced. We as regulators have to try to keep up with this ever-changing, ever-evolving industry. And as you know, sometimes the state and federal governments don't always move at such a fast pace with the technology as the industry does. So this is a challenge for us, and it's one that we're going to do. It's one of the reasons that we're here today. So back on topic, we have three operations involved in oil production, essentially, if you want to generalize things. We have drilling, pumping, and then what to do with produced water management. These are, in a sense, where Dogger and the water boards would be involved mostly. You see here that we have these four wells. These are simplified diagrams, and they show, though, that oftentimes we have what's called directional drilling. We'll have drilling that doesn't go straight down. So often it's angled, often it's angled when it straightens out. It can start to approach horizontal. It does become horizontal at times, and sometimes even does a U-shape, it'll start coming back towards the surface. There are times when you'll have one central borehole and you'll have multiple holes off the side. You'll have abandonments
And we'll have reworks where they go back through the hole and maybe block it off here and then they'll go straight down for as an example. So, I'm sure everyone's seen these on the side of the road, and most of us have, most of us know these are pumping units with pump jacks, but I want to explain them quickly so we know what's going on underground. This is another, just a case story. It's a schematic of what's going on subsurface and then what we see on the top. I'm not going to go into great detail about all these terms, but you can see that you have a hole in the ground, there's perforations here in the oil producing zone, there's a pump, it pulls fluid through here, it's powered by this lever and this counterbalance. These are called horse heads, it's one term that's used to describe them. This moves up and down, it pulls the fluid through here, and then the hydrocarbons leave and go to a general line. Now, it's hard, it's not shown here, but in this you can see there's a pipe coming out right there. Usually you have natural gas coming up as well as oil, and the gas will be, will go through one pipe, and then the produced water and the oil will go through the lower pipe usually. All right, so this is not my attempt to be humorous. This is actually a problem for operators. In fact, back in 1915, when the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources became an institution, and the Senate bill that passed that was passed to form that went through, it says, I'll paraphrase here, it says in the bill that the intent of the bill is to protect California's oil resources from the threat of groundwater intrusion. So, at the time, this was a kind of a unique aspect of California drilling was produced water, or I'm sorry, was groundwater getting into the oil. As I said before, usually the oil forms from some sort of a marine environment, or often does, and that water was entrapped with petroleum as sediments buried. And there probably is an aspect of meteoric waters filtering through and going down into the formation as well. So in California, there's about 8 to 10 barrels on average of water produced for every one barrel of oil that is produced. If it helps you think of it as every one barrel of oil that's pumped up, 8 to 10 barrels of water are pumped up as well. Some places more, some places less. So where does it come from and what happens to it? What do we do with this produced water after it comes up with the soil? Well, to answer that question, I want to explain two common types of petroleum traps. These are two common types that we have here in California. I'll show you an example of that in cross-section in a few slides. So, as I mentioned before, there's often water intermingled with the oil. And you can see that right here. This is the water, and this is the oil. This is a little bit of a simplified diagram. In California, for instance, we just think of oil as on top of water. That's not always the case. We have some thick oil in California, and sometimes it is not flowing on top of water. In fact, the water flows on top of it. Sometimes it is intermingled with oil mixed in much more than it shows. But this is just to give you an illustration of how an oil reservoir works. So as this is called an anticline, or an anticline, this is an anticlinal trap. So you have a rock down here that probably is where the oil is produced. The oil, as it becomes, or the kerogen turns into oil, it wants to migrate upwards toward the surface. Well, if nothing stops it, you'll have surface expressions, which we do see throughout California. I think the little red tar pits, that would be a good example of one of those places. But often we have something called cap rock. A cap rock is a geologic unit that is impermeable, so fluids have a hard time moving through it. So you often have a pooling of fluids here and gas as well. This is a fault trap. You can see here that there's a disconformity between the beds, so these beds don't carry on. This is the fault right here. And what will happen in this case is a fault will essentially put cap rock in place of the migration of fluids, and it'll become trapped here. And then you can see that there's a drill rib above that. And this is where the water comes from and why we have water in our oil.
essentially.
Like I said, these are very simplified diagrams, but I think they convey the point. So, in the next slide, I'm going to show you a cross-section of an example of those traps that we have here, just so you can place something regionally that we deal with. This is where the cross-section is going to be. So here's Lompoc, here's Sisquat, Gary, respectively, and the cross-section would be like if we took a slice out of cake and we're going to be looking at the side of the cake. And so this would be where we make the knife cut. All right, so here this is. So if you can see Lompoc's to the southwest, and here is Sisquat. So those traps I explained earlier, this is an example of an anticline right here, an anticline trap with some fall traps below. And you see all these oil wells right through here. We have numerous fall traps here, 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 and you can see once again that there's oil wells that are above those traps. So this is a simplified cross-section, but it illustrates the point that we have those types of petroleum reservoirs in our own region. So, produced water. What do we do with it? Well, back in 1902, we saw that slide where I showed you Santa Barbara Beach. Probably a lot of that produced water was either put back in the ocean or it was put in a sump and percolated or evaporated out. That has not been the case probably since the 1930s. That started to fade away and injection wells started to become more widely used. In fact, today, that is the most widely used method of disposing of produced water. I think 90% is somewhere around where most of the produced water goes is through injection wells. So this actually right here is a cyclic steam well. This is in the Orca oil field, which is near the city of Orca. And what happens with this well is that the produced water in this case is turned into steam, and the steam is injected into this well. And it's well cycled between production, which is pumping the fluid out of the ground, and steaming. So it will steam, it will loosen up the oil, which is very thick, and increase mobility. And then the steam will switch off after maybe a week or so, and the pump will turn on and it will pump up. And these are essentially pump jacks here. They're a different kind than the common horseheads that we saw, but they do the same thing. This is a surface discharge. We still do have this. There's two places that we have this. One is in Arroyo Grande, and this in particular is in San Ardo. Now, we're not just allowing operators to dump produced water directly into the river. If you worry about that, they do have an MPDES permit. And this is highly treated water. This has gone through a reverse osmosis plant. This is better than what's coming out of your tap. I can almost guarantee that. And this is essentially setting up a wetlands. And then it percolates down, and the San Ardo River runs right in the background there. Salinas River. Salinas River, I'm sorry. Yes, Salinas River. This is, I'll come back to this in a minute. This is the plant at Arroyo Grande that essentially does the same thing that goes on here, but in this case, they're emptying into Pismo Creek. This is operated by Freeport MacMoran. They have a reverse osmosis facility here as well. And same thing, it's treated, high treated water, they put this into Pismo Creek instead of habitat or steelhead. And they have a permit with us as well for that. And often, to get to the steam here, this plant right here will purify the water and then convert it to steam. So finally we have the groundwater discharge. Now this, in a sense, is not your typical earthen sump. I'm going to show you an example of that. We don't have too many of them in our region, but we do have some. This operator probably would refer to this as a skimming pond. So this is cement lined, and there's been so much produced water in here that I'm sure there's a film of oil or pitch on the bottom. This water is not percolating anywhere. What likely happens is it's stored here temporarily, and it's sent to likely these tanks, or then it's either injected or taken off site. But, all right, so the underground injection control program. I'm going to go through each underground injection control and those sumps, and I'll also address hydraulic fracturing as we go along from here on. So the underground injection control program was formed by the US EPA. There are different types of injection wells. The oil industry is not the only industry that uses injection wells. Class two wells are the wells that are used by the oil and gas industry. And in our state, Dogger is a prime civil program. So the state of California applied for cooperative primacy agreement with the EPA, and Dogger, Division of Oil and Gas Geothermal Resources, is the organization that runs that. We also have a say in that as well, but Matt will talk more about that when it is his turn to speak. So there's three categories. Class two injection wells. There's disposal, there's enhanced oil recovery, and there's hydrocarbon storage. Hydrocarbon storage, I'm not going to focus on. That really is where hydrocarbons are essentially stored underground in reservoirs. I believe the big gas leak down in the LA region in last fall was an example of a natural gas storage that essentially will leak out. I won't go into details of that, but that's an example of that. Disposal and enhanced oil recovery wells. The majority of injection wells in the state of California are enhanced oil recovery, and the majority of those are cycling steam. Disposal wells are where they inject the produced water without any treatment, usually back into the formation that they took it out of. In some cases, they eject it into another formation, and that's where the aquifer exemption program will come into, which we'll cover in a minute. So here's an example of a type of injection well called a water flood well. In essence, it's sort of this simple in how it works. This water is injected through this flow right here, the produced water usually. It's usually taken out of this formation as well, injected back into it, and it pushes the oil bearing zone, which is labeled one here, so a little bit darker than blue. It pushes the oil towards the production well, and then it enables the production well to more easily and readily pump it. Water flooding could be considered a type of enhanced oil recovery. If we want to go back and use that term again, it is increasing the mobility of the fluid in order to assist this well to pump up. Hydraulic fracturing, so this is the big one that is in the news, say, quite a bit. So, hydraulic fracturing is a well stimulation technique. There's often two components to it, and it's bare minimum, it's mechanical. So it involves high pressure and involves something called probands or probands. These four squares here are probands that can be used. This is sand, this is a synthetic sand, I believe, and these two are resin covered sands. And so what happens with the probands is once the fluid is ejected through the well bore, these fissures open up, the operators need those fissures to stay open for a time so the oil can be extracted. So the probands go into those micro fissures and they hold them open temporarily. Now, oftentimes though, there's more going on. There's a chemical component that usually happens, often happens with hydraulic fracturing, and that is where certain fluids or chemicals are put in with the water, and such things as emulsifiers, friction reducers, demulsifiers. Emulsifiers is a fluid that, or a catalyst in essence, that makes two fluids that wouldn't normally mix. There's various reasons why an operator would want to do this. I'm not going to go into too much detail because I'm not an expert on that. There's some people actually who work for the industry who are exceptionally well versed in this. The main point is that there can be two components to hydraulic fracturing. So, and I'll talk about our region, what's going on in our region in a minute. First, I want to say that California is not prepared. We have a different geology here. We have a different set of regulations. And those are important to keep in mind as we work with the oil industry and we work with the state legislature and the public on how to regulate hydraulic fracturing. I'll address the regulation first. Is we, California, in 2014, when SB4 was passed, was the most comprehensive piece of legislation at the time. It is, well, I'll let Matt get into great detail, but it doesn't let what California here what happened back east for the Bakken Shale. The geology in California is much different to back east. The Bakken Shale was the big shale play, big shale unit that gets a lot of coverage. in North Dakota and Nebraska, those states, goes on continuously laddering hundreds of miles. We don't have a formation like that in California. The big formation that if operators do want to frack would, or hydraulic pressure, would be the Monterey Formation. It's pocketed, it is not continuous, and there are different qualities and aspects to it as well that make these big, these long horizontal wells that are going for miles impractical. I intentionally use this vertical well diagram of a hydraulic pressure well because this is what we would probably see here in California. And what we do usually see. We have mostly vertical, and we have micro fractures that extend out usually 1 to 3 meters from the perforation site. And this is what we would most likely see here in region 3. And I say we would see because as far as I know, based on the records from 2014 when reporting started, there are no hydraulic fracture wells in region 3. Now, there's a site called Frac Focus where there are 3 wells listed. If there was 2 weeks ago when I checked this, I went and fact-checked those wells. One of the API numbers is wrong and it doesn't exist as a well. The other well is in misplaced and it is in the Central Valley. And then the other well is an observation well. So that's according to DARS data. And that could I could be mistaken as well. But either way, hydraulic fracturing is not an issue currently in our region. Doesn't mean it won't be. But right now, it's not a major player in oil production. So produced water ponds. This is an issue that we're addressing right now. And there's a semantics issue with produced water ponds. Because I have written there ponds versus sumps. Back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the Water Board did a number of studies, our region did, on the impact of sumps on groundwater and surface water, and most of the ponds, I should say, but the ponds were referred to as sumps. In the regulatory industry, we're trying to differentiate between the two and call ponds those things which are more temperate or which are more permanent and produced water goes into, and sumps, which we are trying to associate with drilling. These terms are not widely standardized yet, but we're using them for our purposes to help us differentiate between the two. Because as you'll see, we need to address each of these as its own issue. Potential groundwater impacts not fully understood. I mentioned in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they had done a number of studies. This was prior to RCRA. I think all these were done prior to the Safe Drinking Water Act. So groundwater and groundwater dynamics were in their infancy, so to speak, and us understanding them as a culture and as a nation and as a state. And so, real thorough assessment of impacts of ponds and sumps has never really been done, but that's what we're attempting to do right now. Another issue that we have is that these are generally undocumented. Historically, they've been everywhere. They've been all over oil fields. They're oftentimes obscured because the earthing sumps need to be moved, otherwise they have that buildup of pitch that I talked about earlier when I showed that lined cement line sump. And water will not percolate through, which for produced water sumps, that is going counter to what they want those sumps to do. So how do we find these sumps? Well, we use satellite images, ArcGIS data, Google Earth. We have old reports and documents that we can go look at. We have operators who are reporting to us. 1327s have been helpful. And we also have visual inspection where we go out and we look for sumps as well. Sumps and ponds. So, once again, what is a produced water pond? This is an issue that we run into as well. So this is in Lynch Canyon oil field. This is southeast of the city of San Ardo. It's east of the San Ardo oil field. And according to this operator, this is not a produced water pond. This is secondary containment. This does not usually have produced water in it. It's there in case one of these tanks, at least to my understanding, is if any of these tanks leak or they get full and they have an emergency and they need to fill this up, they could put produced water into it. So one of the challenges that we're facing and that we're attempting to answer is, well, how do we classify this and what do we do with this? Because it's not made to permanently hold water, but it is made to potentially hold produced water. What is a sump? Is this a sump? or an operator. This is a temporary site where vacuum trucks, which are those large trucks with tanks on them, they'll sometimes take water, but they'll transport water in solid waste, and they'll dump them in a place like this temporarily until they can move somewhere else. This is in the Paris Valley oil field, which is in the west of Santa Barbara. And in this case, the operator once again said they have no records of this and that this is not a sump, and it is something altogether different. So we, one of the things we're doing is working with operators so we can come to we can develop a general consensus about what we're looking for and how we want to define these. All right. Quickly, four examples of this in our oil field or in our region. This is a classic earthen sump. This is in the South Coyama oil field out in Coyama Valley. You can see here that it's made completely of earth. There is no liner. If you go on Google Earth and look at historical data, you see these are constantly moving. And they have to do that once again, so percolation can happen. This is Gaviota oil facility. This is, looks very good. There's a cement liner, there's a neoprene liner. It's well maintained. So we have this in the Santa Maria oil field, similar to the last slide. It's probably used for vacuum trucks, however, they produce water with liquid, but here as well. And it's not in such good shape. And then we have this out in Morales Canyon oil field. This is in Coyama Valley on the north side of it, in the Trembler Range. And this has been used for produced water, hasn't been used in decades. But it's covered with vegetation and it's in a remote place in the oil field. So we have a large gamut of what we call sumps or ponds in our region. All right, I'm going to pass the mic to Matt right now, and he's going to go over the reservoir overview.
Thank you, Aaron. I'd just like to point out for the record that Aaron is actually not feeling very well. He came down ill last night, so hopefully I can do as well as he did in feeling as good as I do. So I'm going to talk to you more about kind of the regulatory issues, some of the recent legislation, and what we're doing, and where we're headed. So there's a number of agencies that are involved in the regulation of active oil fields, starting with USEPA at the top. As Aaron mentioned, they're the keepers or the gatekeepers of the Class II injection, underground injection control program. More specifically, Department of Conservation, Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, and I'll just call them DOGGR henceforth. They more actively regulate oil production activities in the state with respect to drilling, the operation, maintenance, abandonment of production wells, and injection wells. We also have a role as well, historically, in coordinating with DOGGR. How well that occurred over the past 30 years is a topic of another discussion. I'll just touch on it briefly throughout the slide. But specifically, we were supposed to provide technical advice and kind of an advisory capacity to DOGGR with respect to the historical permitting of underground injection control wells. Also, direct regulatory oversight with respect to the ponds and the sumps that Aaron was just talking about. Also, at the local level, land use agencies have a hand in issuing conditional use permits for active oil fields, and the county health departments as well are active in ensuring that public safety is addressed within the oil fields. So that is here. And excuse me, I think I've got something out of sync. No, actually, we're good. Okay. Excuse me. All All right, so we want to talk about the permitting of injection wells. As Aaron talked about, there's a class two injection wells, for disposal of produced water for enhanced oil recovery. The UIC program was promulgated pursuant to the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. And as Aaron mentioned, before you can use or inject, a fluid into an aquifer, you have to have an aquifer exemption, and those are subject to US EPA approval. And the overall intent is to protect underground sources of drinking water, and that's the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act definition of drink sources of drinking water. It's very similar to our own state policy for drinking water policy. Now, let's talk really briefly about the aquifer exemption criteria. So, an aquifer can be exempted if it meets certain criteria, and this is kind of a truncated version of what the federal CFRs say. But essentially, you can only exempt an aquifer. It does not serve as a source of drinking water. It will not or cannot serve as a drinking water because it's within a mineral or hydrocarbon or geothermal zone. So you've basically got large amounts of oil or gas that are already mixed in with the water. It doesn't make it suitable for drinking water purposes. Also, if it's at a depth or location, it just makes it economically infeasible to produce drinking water for public use, or if it's contaminated to a level that it's just not suitable for drinking water purposes. Or the following trumps the previous: if it has the water in the aquifer contains total dissolved solids concentrations that are between 3,000 milligrams per liter and 10,000 milligrams per liter. I'd also just like to note out that if the water has a total dissolved solids concentration that's greater than 10,000 milligrams per liter, it does not meet the definition of an underground source of drinking water. So in those cases, it's easier to get an aquifer exemption if you've got really high TDS concentrations. Now, our historical coordination with Dogger goes back to the 80s. In 1981, Dogger applied for primacy for the underground injection control program with US EPA, and they subsequently received primacy of that. And there's a 1982 memorandum of agreement between Dogger and US EPA for the implementation of that program. Subsequent to that, we have a memorandum of agreement, the State Water Resources Control Board, with Dogger to help them with the review of underground injection control permits to ensure that they're appropriately sited and that the fluids will remain within the exempted aquifer and will not impair any beneficial uses. That MOA also addresses information sharing the State Water Board and the Regional Water Boards as the lead agency for the permitting of produced water bonds and sumps. Now, how well that coordination has played out over the last 30 years is a matter of opinion, but by most standards, it's fallen short. And I'm not going to go into why. I'd be speculating, but I think there's a number of factors that contributed to that were outside of our control as well as within our control. Here's what I call game changers. And over the last 5 to 6 years, there's been very significant heightened public concern over hydraulic fracturing. And so that's brought a public and legislative focus on active oil field production within the state. Part of what contributed to this was an audit by US EPA of Dogger's underground injection control program. And I'll talk about that more in detail in subsequent slides. But about the same time US EPA was doing an audit, the legislature was crafting SB4, the hydraulic fracturing bill. And that's primarily focused on regulatory oversight of hydraulic fracturing, and the way the bill frames it is well stimulation treatments in general, but it's more specific to hydraulic fracturing. One of the bills that we kind of left out of the mix in our staff report, and John Borkovich just mentioned it to me a couple of days ago, and I thought very appropriate to put in here, was Senate Bill 1281. And this one had to do with heightened concerns and interest over the large amounts of water that are produced and used in active oil field production. So it addresses that. And that was adopted in 2014. And then, as John mentioned, the Budget Rider Bill of 2015, Senate Bill 83, is more focused on the coordinated oversight between DARs and the water boards for underground injection control and the regulation of produced water ponds. SB 83 was fairly specific to some of the results that came out of the US EPA audit. The way I look at it, it seems like it was a response to helping correcting some of the issues that were identified. So in 2011-2012, US EPA did an audit of the UIC program. They found some substantial implementation deficiencies on DAGR's side. I won't go into these here. DAGR has and has been in the process of correcting these, some of which have been in coordination with the State Water Board. More specific to our roles and our water quality concerns was that the audit identified some significant discrepancies that were associated with the memorandum agreement and EPA approved aquifer exemptions. Essentially, it identified that EPA had a list of exempted aquifers and DAGR had a list of exempted aquifers and they didn't match up, and that there were a large number of wells in excess of 2,500 underground injection control wells that had been permitted and are currently under operation in areas where there are not formally exempted aquifers. I just wanted to point out, at the time that DAGR entered into a memorandum of agreement with EPA to implement the UIC program, there was a list of what they call the pre-1973 aquifer exemptions, and those are the formal aquifer exemptions that we have. But where the boundaries of the underground injection control well permits have been issued go outside of those areas. So we're in the process of addressing those, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. I'm going to go over each of the bills and just highlight some of the more specific elements kind of germane to what's going on with us and where we're going. For the hydraulic fracturing bill, it required the Natural Resources Agency to conduct a kind of a third-party independent scientific study so that we could get a better understanding of the well stimulation technologies and the associated risks. We're, you know, as Aaron was saying, you know, the technology and oil production is outpaced us with respect to our regulatory oversight and our understanding of technology. So this was something to help inform us as well as the decision makers from top to bottom. It also required DAGR to do a number of things, specifically to adopt new rules and regulations associated with construction, operation, testing, permitting, and the inspection of well stimulation wells. It also spoke to interagency consultation and coordination between DAGR, specifically between DAGR and the state and regional water boards. It also spoke to other agencies like Air Resources Control Board, Department of Fish and Game, anybody who would have a hand in some of the associated issues with active oil field production. And then it also, and I italicize this because this shows up again and again, and I'll talk about it at the end of the presentation, but it also established some mandates for the oversight agencies to be transparent with the public and the legislature and be accountable. So they're requiring that all of the information that is going to be reported associated with well stimulation treatments, the volume of fluids, the chemical makeup of the fluids that are being injected, where the wells are, All that information is going to be available to the public, and that was mandated by the legislature through SB 4. It also required the State Water Resources Control Board to develop a strategic and scientifically based groundwater monitoring program. And I'll talk about that a little bit more specifically, just in general terms, in the next slide. And as John pointed out, we also got one position for our program through this bill. So the groundwater monitoring program that the legislature directed the State Water Board to develop is formally called the Model Criteria for Groundwater Monitoring in Areas of Oil and Gas Well Stimulation, otherwise known as the Model Criteria. So the State Water Board, they've already developed this. They're in the process of implementing it in a phased approach. And it essentially has three components. One is an area-specific monitoring requirements for operators. So prior to allowing them to do well stimulation treatments, there has to be a monitoring plan in place, and the State Water Board needs to review it and give Dogger the high sign that it is sufficient before Dogger is going to give the operators a permit for well stimulation treatments. It also includes a regional monitoring component that is being implemented by the State Water Board. And this is looking at the areas surrounding the oil fields to provide kind of a baseline today and to look at ongoing assessment to make sure that the fluids that are being used and injected in the aquifer are not moving outside of the exempted aquifer areas, they're not impacting other beneficial use wells, particularly drinking water wells. And then they also had a smaller component that developed standards for technical third parties to provide sampling to private property owners in the vicinity of well stimulation treatment wells who wanted to have their well sampled. They were concerned about the water quality in their wells. So they developed a framework for doing that. I think there was only perhaps one property owner in the state that actually opted to participate in that program. I think it was down in Region 4. So all the data that's going to be generated through the model criteria is all going into GeoTracker. It's all going to be publicly available. State Water Board is also contracted with Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories and the United States Geologic Survey to do some special studies and some pilot studies and some case studies to try to better understand how we can best do ongoing assessment with respect to the active oil fields and well stimulation treatments. And so they've already been kind of presenting technical seminars to staff based on the outcomes of those special studies to help inform us moving forward with respect to how to do ongoing assessment. So SB 1281, as I mentioned, had to do with produced water, because as people started to look at this, they realized just how much water was being moved around back in oil fields. So what SB 82 is primarily focused on requires monthly operator reporting to Dogger of oil and gas production volumes, the number of wells that are either in the process of being drilled or producing, injecting, or idle. And these are, as I said before, monthly. But also, a big focus of this bill is the reporting of the volume and the ultimate disposition of the produced water. And that also includes any makeup water that may be derived from other sources other than the produced water. In some cases, operators, to effectively implement their enhanced oil recovery techniques, they may need additional water and they may blend it. So, and they also are requiring descriptions of the different types of water treatment. So it's just going to be a water balance. What's coming in, what's going out, where is it going, what does it look like, what's added to it. All of that is going to be reported to Dogger by the operators. It also requires Dogger to provide annual reports to the state and the regional water boards inventorying all of the unlined sumps within their districts. And so this is kind of going to help augment our existing efforts and wrapping our hands around where these sumps are, so that we can go out and make sure that they're appropriately constructed and permitted if they're not abandoned. And we'll talk about what we're doing with respect to the ponds in a future slide. And SB 83, again, I just want to point out that this was essentially a response to the US EPA audit of the UIC program. And this basically codifies the aquifer exemption process requirements for Dogger and the State Water Board's coordinated review of these of any future proposed aquifer exemptions. Before, this was, you could say it was somewhat informal as part of the 1988 MOA, but now the legislature has essentially mandated this coordination and requested Dogger the audit. Barlow will talk about the audit a little bit more, but it also is part of that coordination. It mandates the implementation of a 30-day public comment period and a public hearing prior to the State Water Board and Dogger making a joint recommendation to US EPA to approve an aquifer exemption. This kind of speaks to that public accountability and transparency issue. Previously, underground injection control permitting and aquifer exemptions weren't necessarily vetted publicly. People weren't made aware of or provided an opportunity to comment on it. And the legislature saw this as something that was a necessity moving forward so that we could be accountable. It also required the State Water Resource Control Board to report on the regulation of the produced water sumps. That's what the legislation called it. But primarily what we're talking about are the ponds here. And so the State Water Board is producing a report every 6 months, and they're publishing it online. And I'll show you a breakdown of the first report with some modifications based on more recent data. And there's also a table in the staff report that shows that. It requires Dogger and the State Water Resources Control Board to also provide detailed UIC program implementation reports to the legislature every 6 months. Basically, what the legislature wants to know is, how many permit applications have been submitted, how long does it take to process them, and what are you, basically, how are you implementing the program consistent with the US EPA guidelines for the UIC program? And again, John pointed out we got three positions from SB 83, so it was a huge boon for us, but a lot more positions went to Dogger and the State Water Board because of Region 5 is how much more significant the workload is on their level. So here's a breakdown of kind of the first iteration of our produced water pond inventory. I want to point out that I actually made some modifications to this table from what you see in the staff report. Because we've been receiving data from some of the operators, and so we've corrected it there. So I just want to show here, we've got for the Central Coast region here, we've got active ponds. There's 38 that we've identified so far that are active, three of which are permitted. In the staff report, in the parentheses, I had unpermitted, and I thought this was just an easier way to filter the information. So 35 of the active ponds in our region are currently not subject to waste discharge requirements permit. We've identified 8 inactive ponds, none of which are permitted. So we'll have to look at those with respect to whether or not they're going to remain in service, they're going to be closed, and permit them. So 46 total ponds in the region, 3 of which are unpermitted. This is 3 less than what the State Board website currently shows. So we'll work with John and his group to get that updated. With respect to these ponds, we've got 15 current enforcement actions. Those are all 13267 orders that we've issued to the operators to report to us on the number, location, size of the sumps, their historical operation, how much fluid has been discharged into them, and for what purposes chemical makeup of the produced water as it's discharged into the ponds. The enforcement actions could also include things like notice of violations or cleanup and abatement orders with respect to not providing enough data, incomplete reports, non-response to 13267s. And we're in the process of kind of evaluating those different scenarios with respect to what we've seen. So we've sent out 15 13267 orders for the ponds and the salts. We received 12 responses so far to those 13267 orders. The amount of information that we've requested for these is fairly significant. In addition to the pond sump data, we're also asking for an accounting of all the water supply wells within a 1 mile radius and any water quality data, historic water quality data that's associated with those supply wells, as well as requiring new samples from those wells to be collected and reported with those data. All I want to point out with the Central Valley is just how significantly larger their pond inventory is than ours. So as a result of the US EPA audit and the Senate bills, we've got this kind of renewed coordination between the State Water Board, Regional Water Boards, and Dogger. In response to that US EPA audit, Dogger and the State Water Board submitted an action plan in February of 2015 to US EPA, outlining how they were going to address not only the implementation deficiencies with respect to Dogger's oversight of the UIC program, but also how we're going to assess and deal with the vast numbers of underground injection control wells that have been permitted outside of exempted aquifers, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. In response to SB4, Dogger and the State Water Board entered into a new memorandum of agreement in December of 2015 that's regarding well stimulation treatments and well stimulation treatment related activities. So this is focused on hydraulic fracturing and the coordination between Dogger and State Water Board and regional water quality control boards in the review of those well stimulation treatment permits. It also speaks to the State Water Board's implementation of the Monroe criteria for groundwater monitoring and making sure that an operator area-specific monitoring program is in place before the well stimulation treatment permits are issued. Dogger and the State Water Board also developed a new aquifer exemption process guidance document in April of 2015. And this is just one of a number of guidance documents that I have a list of on the backup slide at the end of the presentation. I won't go into here, but US EPA has a guidance document. UIC program speaks to it. There's a number of guidance documents and criteria. The existing 1988 MOA is also in the process of being revised, and that will again speak more specifically to coordinated oversight between Dogger and State Water Board and regional boards with respect to the implementation of UIC programs, specifically review of aquifer exemptions and underground injection control permitting and oversight of ponds and subs. And there's also a lot of ongoing data and information sharing that's going on between the water boards and Dogger at this point. So the action plan was developed in response to the US EPA audit. Is essentially to ensure that aquifers being injected to are not underground sources of drinking water. So that's in compliance with the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. It's also for the review of proposed UIC project proposals that are submitted by operators to ensure that the protection of groundwater beneficial uses, to make sure that that injected fluid is going to stay within the targeted zone, it's not going to leave the exempted aquifer area. And it's also really focused on a review of those existing underground injection control wells that were permitted outside of the exempted aquifers. And now I'm going to talk a little bit more about that process. So as part of that review, State Water Resources Control Board reviewed copious amounts of well data from Dogger to try to identify the high-risk wells and create kind of a risk-based tiered approach to evaluating those. And they've already gone through the process of identifying the highest risk wells and having injection cease into those wells. And I don't think there's any in our region specifically. Most of them have been in Region 5 that were shut down. In our region, however, the 13267 orders that we issued were for the first two categories of kind of a three-tiered category of risk wells. And I won't go over what those categories are unless you want to. We've got those listed at the end of the presentation. So we've issued 15, or actually for the UIC evaluation, we've issued 12 13267 orders. And in the process of reviewing those data, we've received four submittals. A lot of the operators have come back to us and said, you're asking us for a lot of information here, so this is going to take a little bit more time. Some of the operators who had an easier time with it were able to put together their package more expediently, but others have reached out to us with good faith efforts and said, we're doing it, this is what we've got so far, we're in the process of getting a package together, and we intend to do so by a certain date. And in some cases we have non-responders and we're going to have to deal with those as well. So we're reviewing them, the responses, to evaluate the proximity to water supply wells and the potential impacts to water quality and beneficial uses. That's really our primary focus. And ultimately, the end game is to either bring those wells into compliance via a US EPA approved aquifer exemption or to have the wells shut down. So here's the new aquifer exemption process that has been developed between the State Water Board and Dogger. So starting up in the upper left-hand corner, the operator is going to submit technical information to Dogger in support of their aquifer exemption request. Dogger is going to review that, and once they deem it to be complete, they'll submit it to the State Water Board, and they're going to consult with us. How we've done this for the first one that's happened in the state for the River Grande Aquifer Field, we had staff from each our office and the State Water Board do kind of a joint technical review. We each provided our recommendations, and then State Board compiled those and submitted them to Dogger. And then the next step, Dogger is going to prepare an aquifer exemption application that is going to go to US EPA. And then here's the public comment and hearing component. So before Dogger submits it to EPA, there's a 30-day public comment period, and there'll be a public hearing. We'll give people an opportunity to come speak to the exemption application.
But that's a Dogger hearing, right?
It's a joint hearing.
Right. State Board and Dogger hearing, and just for, if I can jump in, just for clarification, the Arroyo Grande aquifer is actually passed through to where Dogger submits the AE application to US EPA. That's already happened too for the Arroyo Grande aquifer exemption. So they've already done the public participation. Dr. Wolf and myself attended that in September. There are actually multiple public comment periods associated with the aquifer exemption. And right now we're in a dialogue. It's a three-way dialogue, US EPA and the consultants. State Board and the Regional Board are in a dialogue about the technical components and merits, the multiple lines of evidence supporting the recommendation for approval of the aquifer exemption. That's an ongoing dialogue right now.
How many aquifer exemptions do we have in state?
Lots.
Yeah, in the range of maybe 200, you know, very rough estimate there. Probably 40 in the region.
Yeah, it's about right.
Something like that. Yeah. Okay. And there, many of them are in states of change as a result of what Matt has highlighted.
And the guidance documents that were prepared, do they align all together, or are they sort of disparate in their guidance?
The different agencies.
Yes, I understand the different agencies.
Right.
Is there some sort of regulatory alignment in that?
Yes, now there is, yes.
Yeah.
That, great highlight, that's new, that alignment.
One thing I really want to point out here, as far as the public comment, public hearing component here, this is not new to us. This is what we do. This is new to Dogger. This has never really occurred for them. So there's kind of this cultural shift that's occurring for them to be more accustomed to this. I think the first hearing that John spoke to, they sat silent pretty much in the back of the room. So it goes after public comment. It goes to the US EPA along with the comments and our joint responses to those comments as part of the request application to US EPA. And then US EPA has the ability to either approve or deny, or they can do what they're doing now and say, we have some questions. We'd like some more information.
No, if all possible, maybe we should hold off our questions until you finish your presentation and...
Sure, that's fine. And also, just as the note here in the bottom, any stage in the game, either the Dogger or the State Water Board or the US EPA can go back a next step and kind of revisit and do a redo. Let's see with that one. So what are we doing? So with respect to the underground injection control program, really right now what we're really focusing on is reviewing the responses we're getting from the 13267 letters asking for information about those UIC wells that have been permitted in non-exempted aquifers. And the orders, the 12 orders we issued, that includes 47 wells. And so we're getting data on those wells with respect to their construction information, their operations, their maintenance, the amount and quality of the fluid that's being injected into them. Also, we're looking at all of the water supply wells that are within a 1 mile radius of those, and all of the water quality data and the construction information that's associated with those. It's going to be quite an effort. And as John had mentioned, we're still kind of in the strategic planning phases on what's going to be our stepwise approach in our review and response to these 13267 orders. We're also going to be looking at any injection well failures or well breaches that are brought to our attention by Dogger. In some cases, the well tubing or the casings have a breach, and there's a potential for the injected fluids to go into portions of the formation that are not targeted, that may be water-bearing zones that are being used for other beneficial purposes. We've got one referred to us by Dogger just late last year, and we've got another 13267 letter that we drafted that's currently under our legal review through State Board Office of Enforcement before that goes out, and it's requesting information that will allow us to evaluate whether or not that well has caused a breach and the discharge of fluids into water-bearing formations other than where it was supposed to go. And so we anticipate that we will probably start to see these on a more frequent basis as our coordination continues with Dogger. We'll also be looking at providing kind of a technical review. And again, this is more of an advisory capacity where we just make recommendations through the State Water Board of Dogger with respect to the permitting of any forthcoming individual underground injection control projects. And as well, we'll be looking at and coordinating with the State Water Board of Dogger for the review of any future aquifer exemptions. We've already got one under our belt that is kind of at the last stages of the process. We're anticipating two more this year, one for San Ardo oil field and another one for Cat Canyon. Now, with respect to produced water ponds, this is a more active regulatory role for us, where we have direct authority over the use of these ponds and sumps. We issued 15 13267 orders for these as well. and we've received back 12 responses for those. And again, these orders entail the gathering and reporting of significant amounts of high-level data, and some of the operators have expressed that they need more time to work on. So we're working with them, and we're in the process of prioritizing the responses and reviews of the ones that we currently have in hand. Now, with respect to what's going to happen with those, there's essentially two options. Either we're going to have them formally closed, and we'll do investigations to ensure that they're clean closed, that there's no contaminants in place that pose risks to either surface water or groundwater, in which case we can kind of get them off the books. But in some cases, we may have produced water ponds that operators either want or need to maintain in service, and we're going to have to review and permit those as appropriate, consistent with Title 27 requirements for waste impoundments. And ongoing as required, we'll be considering enforcement with respect to any of these issues within our authority. Here are my take-homes. Oil and gas production is complex, evolving, and we have a lot of catching up to do. I have some, but we have a lot of catching up to do. It's not just with respect to the technology and how the industry has outpaced us, but also with respect to the vast numbers of underground injection control wells that we need to evaluate that have been permitted in non-exempted aquifers. Also with respect to wrapping our arms around the produced water pond issue and getting those either closed and permitted. I'd also like to point out that production-related activities can fluctuate significantly due to market conditions, and that requires the regulatory agencies to be nimble. Over the last decade or so, because of oil prices being high, the oil industry is going gangbusters with production, and so that's part of how they've kind of been outpacing us. But at times, as the prices go down, production might go down. Production-related activities will kind of calm down, but then they can come back again. So there's going to be an ebb and flow that we're going to have to deal with and manage in our oversight. And we're going to have to prioritize in a lot of cases to deal with that. Active oil field production produces and uses vast amounts of water, as we kind of talked about in more qualitative terms. And in this is really kind of ground zero for us. What happens to these fluids? Where do they go? Are they staying where they're supposed to stay? Are they causing water quality impairments or impairments to beneficial uses? So we need to pay attention to that. There's also kind of another component to this is that are there other beneficial uses for this water? In many cases, the operators need it to fill a void that was created by the extraction of the oil and produced water in the first place. Sometimes you can't just leave that vacant void in formation because you could have, I don't know what you call them, sumps or negative pressure, if you subside in some other surface manifestations that are problematic. But I know a lot of people are looking at this water and some of the treatment facilities. These RO facilities produce really high quality water. Can we use it for other beneficial purposes, not just enhance oil recovery or get rid of it? We're coordinating with our Dogger and state water counterparts to implement our mandates. I'm really excited about the new staff that we have. They've hit the ground running. They're bringing with them some really great ideas and some skill sets that are complementary, and I think it's going to enable us to do a really good job in addressing these issues and moving forward. And I'd like to finish with the transparency and accountability component. When I read through all the assembly bills, it struck me that they all had either a focus or mandates that are associated with this to make sure that the public has all the information that we have, all the data that's reported to us is going to be available to them, that we're going to be accountable, we're going to be reporting to the legislature and the public with respect to our actions, the effectiveness of our actions. And again, this is not new for us. We aspire to do this. Dogger, on the other hand, this is there's a cultural shift, and we're working with them. You know, I kind of help them overcome their issues with this, and so we can all become more accountable and transparent together. So with that, if you have any questions.
What I propose is, before starting a round of questions, it's almost 10:30. I think this would be a good time to take a break, because I think we may have quite a few questions from our board members. So let's take a 15-minute break, and we can convene at 10:40.